everybody feel high. But this is no way. Africa Live.
Welcome to Africa Live. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and you're listening to Africa Live here on WhoRadio.com. We've got a great show lined up for you today. We'll be beginning with an interview with Comrade Chernow Alpha Mba, who is the director of organization for the African Socialist International, and has been an organizer in West Africa for a very, very long time. And we want to talk about the situation in West Africa, particularly in Guinea-Conakry and Sierra Leone. Guinea-Conakry is an area where elections are coming up soon, and it's making for a crisis situation. It appears is about to develop around that. So we'll talk about that, and we'll also talk a little later about Sierra Leone, where the African People's Socialist Party held a conference in November, and following that, and establishing the African People's Socialist Party there, there's been a lot of developments there, and so we'll talk about that situation. we want to begin talking about Guinea. First of all, I want to welcome our guest, Comrade Trono Alpha Mba. Uhuru, Comrade.
Yes, Uhuru.
It's always good to have you on.
Yes, thank you very much, Comrade. It's also good to be on Uhuru Radio.
So why don't we start off just discussing Guinea-Conakry. We noted the fact that elections are coming up, but just for those who are unaware of Guinea-Conakry's history, can you give a little bit of background on Guinea-Conakry?
Yes, as you know, Guinea-Conakry was carved out as a colony by the French way back subsequent to the Berlin Conference of 1884, 1885, that sold out Africa to the various imperialist nations of Europe at the time. And subsequent to the Second Imperialist War, and when it became obvious that the ability of the various colonial powers to control the colonies directly was something that was impossible. So there was already in existence in Guinea several workers' organizations, some of which were led by Ahmed Sékou Touré, who voted against the French proposal put forward in 1956 for the incorporation of the French, what was then known as French West Africa, into the French Community of Nations. And subsequent to that, the French withdrew from Conakry, and in 1958, Sékou Touré declared independence at the time. So what we had from 1958 up to 1984 was a progressive regime at the time, Guinea-Conakry, under Ahmed Sékou Touré, who was attempting to apply or implement some form of socialist leadership in that country at the time. And Guinea functioned within that period also as a center for the African Liberation Movement, because we had a situation where the PAIGC, the African Party for the Independence of Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, had its headquarters in Conakry. It operated from Conakry. This was the party of Amilcar Cabral at the time. And subsequent to the coup that overthrew Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana in 1966 up to 1972, Kwame Nkrumah was also in exile in Guinea-Conakry, and he was also named co-president by Ahmed Sékou Touré. Most of the leaders of the Pan-African Congress of Tanzania were also trained in Conakry. You know, several other forces who were fighting for the liberation of Africa, who were fighting against colonial domination during the 70s and 80s, had some assistance also from Guinea-Conakry, and they frequented Sékou Touré, and they operated bases, you know, in Guinea-Conakry. So these, and within this period also, we saw continuous efforts by the French and the various imperialist nations, including the United States, to isolate the regime of Ahmed Sékou Touré at the time. And they declared sanctions, an economic embargo, and this made it difficult for Ahmed Sékou Touré to succeed. And he was subsequent to the coup that overthrew Modibo Keita of Mali and Kwame Nkrumah. It's like Sékou Touré was placed in some form of isolation. So we even had a situation where in 1970 there was also a Portuguese led invasion of Conakry that was defeated by Ahmed Sékou Touré. This was an imperialist aggression that was designed to overthrow the government of Ahmed Sékou Touré, and also eventually it will have resulted in the capture of Kwame Nkrumah, who was in exile in Conakry at the time. So Guinea under Sékou Touré succeeded in repelling that imperialist aggression. It was one that was backed by the French and also the Americans. So from 1958 to 1984, we had a very progressive situation in Guinea that offered hope for the African Liberation Movement. But subsequent to the death of Amadou Toure in 1984, what we saw was a coup that was inspired by the French and the various imperialist nations, which eventually resulted in the establishment of a neo-colonial leadership, a neo-colonial government led by the former neo-colonial dictator, General Lansana Conté, who presided over a neo-colonial government that controlled the country from 1984 up to 2009, December of 2008. So this was the situation that prevailed. And during that period, what we witnessed was the destruction of all the foundations of a progress and program that was advanced by Sékou Touré. This was a period when the entire economy and the certain sector of the economy was sold out to multinational corporations who still control strategic sectors of the economy of Guinea-Conakry. And this was a situation also where dissenting views were suppressed, where opposition to the regime was also repressed, you know, an era of repression, an era that witnessed the what we call, you know, the eradication of all forms of democratic, legitimate democratic struggles in that area. So from the subsequent to the death of Conte also, what we saw was an attempt of a coup also that similar to what Conte did in 1984, that eventually resulted in the establishment of a military dictatorship that has been in control of power up to this point in time. So what we are talking about is a history of political repression, a history of violence, and a situation that was promoted by the various imperialist forces who are controlling the economy of Guinea. As you know, Guinea is the leading producer of bauxite and aluminum resources in Africa. And these resources are controlled by leading American corporations, Alcoa and Alcan, owned by the United States government and the Canadians. You know, and these corporations are also struggling with various other multinational interests from Asia, like the Malaysians and the Japanese, and now increasingly the Chinese. So what we have are political forces who are struggling, supported by these various imperialist networks and corporations, to control the economy of Guinea and also prevent the economic development and progress that is desired by the mass of our people to free themselves from the ongoing hardship and poverty that they continue to experience in 1984 up to now. So in brief, this is the situation that exists in Guinea, and one that is being exacerbated by the current ongoing, you know, campaign to also establish a civilian leadership, a civilian government that is eventually controlled or sponsored by one or both of these imperialist corporations and nations that have over the years controlled the economy of Guinea and created the crisis that the country is now facing.
Now, we did talk on last week some about the current situation with the elections coming up, and could you say something about the current players who are involved in this election in this current election process, and who they're backed by?
Yes, as you know. Following, because the situation is that from 1958 up to now, what we have in Guinea is almost that country has been ruled by two governments. Amadou Sékou Touré that we spoke about, and also the Lansana Conté, who died in December of 2008. So from then on, what we have is a political vacuum in that country. In fact, that vacuum existed following the mass rebellions of January and February of 2007, which crippled the ability of the Guinean regime to control the rest of the country. It was an organized expression of resentment, of a vehement opposition against the corrupt tendencies of the Conte regime and the excesses of the neo-colonial leadership that has sold out at the resources of the country. So this eventually resulted in the establishment of a prime minister that was supported a regime, some kind of coalition arrangement that was supported by the Americans. So subsequent to the coup also, subsequent to the death of Conte, we saw a junior military officer, Captain David Kamara, who was supported by the Chinese and some of the Asian interests to assume power. So there was also a rebellion, an expression, you know, a frustration that was expressed by the Marxists in September of 2009, September last year, when it became clear that David Kamara, who claimed initially that he was not interested in staying in power, turned around and said that he was going to contest the election. So the people came out, and subsequent to that, we saw hundreds of people who were killed as a consequence of that demonstration. So subsequent to September 2007, what they had was an arrangement that resulted in the removal of Dadis Kamara from power, and then the establishment of an interim leadership, and also the development of an election program that will allow for the organization of elections that will eventually result in the establishment of the civilian leadership in that country. So the elections have been scheduled to happen in June, on June 27th, which is barely a few more days from now, almost barely a month from now. And these are elections. The program was developed by ECOWAS, and the timetable for the elections were also advanced by ECOWAS. And there was also an ECOWAS committee that was established to oversee the organization of these elections. But so many things have faltered in this process because, one, ECOWAS advanced the elections program without consulting the masses. And they have done a number of things. They have also amended the constitution, and this was done without a referendum that would have allowed the people to vote or support, express their support or opposition to whatever amendments that were made to the constitution, and also the date for the election. So it means that in their effort to establish a government that they desire in Guinea, the ECOWAS leadership itself has failed to respect the wishes and aspirations of the people of Conakry and Guinea-Conakry as it is. So now, several groups have emerged as a consequence of that situation who have created ethnic constituencies, who have been using campaign slogans that will divide and pitch the ethnic communities in Guinea against each other. And it's a situation that will result into a potential genocide, because each of these tribal or ethnic communities are desperately eager to control whatever government to be in power subsequent to the election. So, and from what we are seeing now, based on the campaigns, there is every possibility that if elections are held, then definitely the elections are going to result into violence, and these result the situation where certain communities are going to fight against each other based on ethnic allegiances, based on ethnic ideas and tribal affiliations that will offer no good for the progress, unity, and development of the masses, the workers, and the peasants in that country. So, and this is a situation that has been created, nurtured, and supported by ECOWAS through the arrangement, the hasty arrangement that they have done in their desperate desire to transform Guinea into what they want it to be, rather than what the people of Guinea, the Africans in Guinea, want to see happen in that part of the continent. And this is a very worrying situation, and a situation that is very, very serious, and that is of grave concern to every individual who is interested, genuinely interested in the development, unity, and progress of our continent and our people as a whole. So that is one aspect of it. The second thing that we find problematic is the fact that most of the individuals who are currently aspiring to who are contending for for public office in that, who are trying to contest that election, are individuals who have contributed to the underdevelopment of that country, to the extraction of resources, to the giving out of concessions to multinational corporations who have exploited and oppressed our people in that area. And these are individuals who have played significant roles in the regime of land and content, and who are blemished, who are guilty of all the crimes that have happened in Guinea, who are responsible for the current misery and poverty that our people experience in that area. Under normal circumstances, we feel that whatever amendments should have been made in that constitution by ECOWAS, through the leadership of ECOWAS, should have been some of the recommendation provisions should have made it impossible for some of these people to contest for any public office in that area because of their history of participation in the government that has committed the worst crimes against our people in that area. So these, among other things, this is what we feel is the situation in that area. And also we think that ECOWAS has also promoted a situation that is not healthy for the development of our people in Guinea-Conakry, because what we are looking at is the repetition of another Rwanda in Africa as it is.
You're listening to Africa Live here on thehuraradio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we are on the line with Chernow Alpha Mba, the Director of Organization of the African Socialist International, who's joining us from West Africa. We're discussing the situation in Guinea-Conakry, where upcoming elections look to be fomenting ethnic violence and a crisis that appears to be on the horizon. We want those of you who are out there listening to participate in the discussion. You can call in or you can email. You can call us at the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599, or you can call us from the U.K. at 020-8133-6629, or you can call us through Skype for free anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase, or email us at dj@uhururadio.com. So, Comrade Chernow, you're also the chief, the president of the West Africa Media Forum, and in your capacity, you sent a letter to the ECOWAS secretariat around the situation in Guinea-Conakry. Can you tell our listeners about that letter?
Well, as part of the mandate of the West African Media Forum, is that we have to alert, part of our responsibility is to help ECOWAS to achieve its objectives, to advise and provide assessment of the situation within the region as far as it relates to human rights and democratic practices that issued that promote good governance and things like that. So, subsequent to my recent visit to Conakry, and having spoken to various individuals and some of the leaders of the trade union movement and some of the civil society organizations, and even some members of some of these political parties in Conakry, I was able to find out that there is overwhelming evidence that political party leaders in that country have been promoting ideas that will fragment the people, that has fragmented the people along ethnic lines, and they have created a situation of animosity that is not good for the unity and progress and peaceful existence of our people in Conakry. So as part of the mandate that we have to draw the attention of ECOWAS to this situation, we addressed a letter on behalf of the West Africa Media Forum to the ECOWAS Secretariat, and we also copied the president of ECOWAS, who happens to be the current president of Nigeria, that this is the situation, among other things, that we feel that the ECOWAS committee in charge of Guinea has made tremendous mistakes by by overlooking or deliberately ignoring the circumstances that has created the political crisis in Guinea, namely the corrupt syndicate that has been developed by the ancient regime of Lansana Conte and individuals who played that significant role that has plunged Guinea into this political situation. The same individuals who are currently vying for public office in that country, and they have also developed and systematized ideas that will not promote the much-needed unity that is needed to save Guinea from decades of imperial exploitation and oppression. So we feel that, if anything, the current situation is a recipe for violence and a situation that will result into a potential genocide, which we feel will affect the entire region, the whole of West Africa. Because what we have is ethnic communities. You have Mandingo communities who are organized along a specific leader. You have Fulani communities organized along a specific leader. And you have the Susu communities, likewise other tribal groups. Dadis Camara, who was the military leader that was sent eventually to exile following an assassination attempt, comes from the southern region of Guinea. And from our own investigations, we have learned that there is currently certain individuals who are developing what looks like a militia organization in that region of Guinea, and they are saying that they will not allow elections to happen in Guinea if Dadis Camara is not allowed to return to Guinea. So these are people who belong to Dadis Camara's own ethnic community. And ECOWAS has ignored the situation. They have failed to take into consideration some of these ideas that these politicians have introduced into the lives and brains of our people, which have created a situation that will result into violence. So we sent this letter as part of an assessment of this situation, and we call for, among other things, that ECOWAS, the current committee in charge of Guinea, should be dissolved, and a new committee that is very neutral should be put into force, and also that the elections should not be held in June, because if they are held in June, then it means that they will be held along the lines that have been established, and which will create nothing but violence. And we also advise that ECOWAS to consider the idea of not allowing the current political leaders who have functioned as ministers and prime ministers in the previous government of Lansana Conte to also contest for higher office in Guinea-Conakry. So we think that this situation is one that will result in the death of many, many people, and we think that ECOWAS will be primarily responsible for this situation if anything happens, if any violence is not as a consequence of this election. So we think that the ECOWAS leadership will be culpable of any violence that will happen in Conakry if the elections are held and if this in June and if it results to violence. That is among other things. So we basically advise ECOWAS as part of our mandate that in the interest of democracy and in the interest of human dignity and for respect of the human rights of our people in Conakry, that they should suspend the elections, and that a very effective time frame should be advanced based on the wishes and endorsement of the people, and also instead of the current campaigns, we have to carry out a mass public education program in Guinea that will allow our people in Conakry to understand that they should not be divided along ethnic lines, along tribal lines, and that all of these parties that are using ethnic slogans and ethnic messages to create constituencies are not doing anything but harming the interests of the masses in that country. So we feel that is responsibility of ECOWAS and all other individuals who are involved in trying to resolve the current situation in Guinea to take into consideration some of these issues which we feel are inimical to progress, to development, and to the peace and well-being of our people and the unity that has existed among these people before these crooked and corrupt politicians are now promoting ideas that will fragment them and push them against each other. Mm-hmm. And we do not want to see the repetition of another Rwanda in this in Africa. So we feel that what ECOWAS has done under the special committee in charge of Guinea is something that is very, very faulty and something that is off the hook. It's something that is very unprincipled. It's undiplomatic, and we don't feel that ECOWAS, that is claiming to promote democracy and human rights to secure the dignity of our people and things like that, should allow itself to be misled by the selfish interests of some of these individuals. So basically, what the West African Media Forum was trying to do through this letter was to call on ECOWAS to abide by its own objectives, to respect its own principles, and to also respect the wishes and aspirations of the people whose taxpayers' money is being used to sponsor the activities of ECOWAS and its various departments. So this is basically what was contained in the letter that was sent to the ECOWAS Secretariat, and which we copied also to the ECOWAS president, who happens to be Goodluck Jonathan, who is currently the president of Nigeria. So this is basically our concern, and we want to make it clear and known that if anything happens in Guinea that will affect the life of any individual in that area, that ECOWAS will be the primary culprit. And we want the world to know that this is the situation.
Uhuru. And can you, we have a caller. Caller, you're on there.
Hello, brother.
Uhuru.
I was just listening to my brother, the chairman of the West African Media Forum, speaking, and I was extremely impressed by the sincerity of his feeling for our people who will die as a result of the machinations of these stooges and these agents for white imperialists. However, my question to him, or what I would like to ask him, is, does it not think that it will make more sense for us who are concerned about our people to address the puppeteers, to direct our anger or our focus or our campaign against the puppeteers, not the puppets? ECOWAS represents a collection of puppets. By directing our concern and anxieties to that level, i.e. the Africans, who themselves are just managers or administrators, I don't think we'll get very far. But if we point directly to those who pull their strings and make them accountable for the genocide that they are fomenting in Guinea-Conakry, I think that would help us. I accept the fact that even the UN, as an international body of the Security Council, is very corrupted. That's the most powerful organization, body, we are told, world body. But even that is corrupted. But I will still suggest that we should petition every world body and use every platform that we can to highlight what is about to happen. It hasn't happened yet, but I think it is important that we should highlight what is about to happen and present evidence. If we were just to say... Sorry?
Continue, bro.
If we were just to say that this is what we think and we want ECOWAS to come in and to prohibit some politicians from participating in the electoral process, I fear that that may seem to be a partisan strategy. I think the most important thing is the human rights of our people, those of our people who are going to die needlessly simply because somebody wants something that is on their soil. Someone wants to exploit them in some way, shape, or form. Now, that is what we need to bring to the attention of every human being on the planet, so that everybody knows that this is what is going on, or that this is about to happen, and that we are in a position to take steps to prevent that from happening, because it hasn't happened yet. So if the world then fails to take action, then we Africans will be well justified to reject that world when that world comes asking us for help in fighting their own problems like terrorism or oil spills or racism and all that stuff. Okay? The world is a small place now. It's a global village. We're all living together on this planet. What happens to my brother in Guinea concerns me in the UK as much as it concerns you in the US. This is no time for any human being to pretend that they don't know what is going on, especially when we have forums like the internet and the stations like Uhuru Radio to publicize what is going on. That is my contribution, my brother. Thank you.
Thank you so much, brother. So there's some good questions that the brother raised there. Is the question of why raise these issues to ECOWAS, but also is there an intention to take this beyond ECOWAS to the UN or other bodies?
Yes, we feel that raising the question, we think we are not raising the question to ECOWAS specifically, because ECOWAS, as it is currently part of the problem. It's part of the problem because the ECOWAS committee that was in charge of overseeing the situation that helped to develop some of these criteria. So what we are basically saying is that we have to alert them that what they have done is a recipe for violence, and that if anything happens, they will be held responsible. Mm. So we hope that this message will be taken out, even if you take this to the UN Security Council or whatever it is. The UN was in the Congo in the 60s when Lumumba was assassinated.
Yes.
So we are not saying that we expect these imperialist organizations that are led by neo-colonial forces, to solve the situation, because they have a material interest in protecting the status quo, in protecting the system the way it is. But what we are saying is that we have to expose it beyond this situation, and this is the stage. This is the initial stage of the process. So what the West African Media Forum or any other organization that's interested in the situation in Guinea, the African Social International, that has been active in Guinea for the past 3, 4, 5 years now, we'll do whatever we can to inform the international community that this is what is happening in Conakry. This is one stage. Then the next process will be the development of a mass education campaign that will be carried out in Guinea-Conakry that will allow the mass more people to understand that this strategy that is being used by these neo-colonial forces is nothing but one that is inimical to their own very existence. And it's something that is undermining. It's something that is not helpful as far as our desire and aspiration for change the control of our own resources, are concerned. So this is part of this is the beginning of a policy. Just one aspect of the various strategies, tactics, and methods that we are going to use to expose the various forces who are nurturing and promoting the idea of violence in Conakry, the idea of a genocide in that area that will affect not only our people in Conakry but Africans throughout the world. Because whatever happens there will affect us physically and psychologically, and it will undermine the very purpose of our existence as a nation, whether on the continent or outside of the continent. So we are doing what we can, and this discussion that we are having now is also part of the process to take the discussion out of the corridors of ECOWAS and beyond to other parts of the world also, so that Africans, wherever we are, we'll help to disseminate this idea, organize, and do whatever we can to expose the situation and alert the rest of the world that this is what is being done to us and our people in that part of the continent. So it is one method. We hope to also send messages and a petition, the various organizations, who are claiming to promote democracy and human rights in the world. But we do not expect, like I said, that the solution is going to come from these organizations, because they are part of the problem. What we are basically opposed to is the fact that ECOWAS is aware of this situation. So, and they are also conscious that this is what is happening. Because if we are able to see it and assess it this way, then they also have the same ability to see it that way. But they have seen the problem, and they have helped to promote the problem. And they have created the problem by creating the basic rules and regulations that have resulted in the current situation. So they are responsible for what has happened. So we are pointing to them that this is what you have done. And if anything that happens because of this, then you are going to be held responsible. And we will take this message to every corner of the world to tell the world that this is what is being done in that area. You know, ECOWAS, I would like to remind people that when the war erupted in Liberia in 1989 to 1990, by the time ECOWAS never had a military force. So it was led by, it was under the presidency of Ghana. I think at the time it was Jerry Rawlings who was president of Ghana. So an ECOWAS meeting was held in Gambia that resulted in the establishment of a military force called ECOMOC. And ECOMOC was dispatched through Liberia with the hope of containing the Liberia situation and creating an environment that would allow the NPFL and the embattled government of Samuel Doe to sit on the table and do some kind of negotiation.
Mm.
And it was even reported that it was General Aquino, the head, the commander of ECOWAS force at the time, who arranged a meeting between Doe, because Doe would not have left the presidential mansion at the time, but he moved him out of the presidential mansion where his guards, his own military forces were deployed, and they were protecting him. So they led him to the conference room, and it was ECOWAS troops, allegedly, who disarmed the bodyguards of Samuel Doe, and then they allowed Prince Johnson and the other rebel forces to attend the meeting well armed. So it was in that meeting that some kind of exchange of fire happened, and ECOWAS just pulled out. ECOWAS troops just pulled out. They never fought the NPFL forces to prevent them from kidnapping Doe at the time. So Doe was arrested in front of the eyes of the ECOWAS, of the ECOMOC force, the ECOWAS military force that was deployed in Liberia to contain the crisis. So they sold that new colonial president, and they had him executed publicly in front of the eyes, you know, and feet of ECOWAS troops. So they never did anything. And at the time, nobody has been able to find that it was ECOWAS that created that situation. So what we are saying is that those days are gone. When somebody will create a situation that they are conscious of, that this situation will create such a crisis of unimaginable proportion, then without us blowing the whistle and allowing them to know that this is what has been done, and it's very wrong. So this discussion that we are having right now is part of the process of removing the petition within the corridors of ECOWAS and taking it beyond that and allowing the rest of the world to know that this is what is being done. So we hope to hold press conferences and also send messages to every corner of the world and let them know that this is what is happening, that if elections are allowed to happen on June 27th, and based on the current campaign slogans and the messages that is being disseminated in that area, then we believe that everything, there's a possibility that the elections will result into violence of unimaginable proportion if nothing is done to correct the current ideas and the conduct and activities of the current political leaders who are campaigning for the presidency of that country.
You're listening to Africa Live here on thehooradio.com. We're on the line with Chernow Alpha Mba, the director of organization of the ASI, who is joining us from West Africa. And we're discussing the situation in Guinea-Conakry, where the forces who are running in the upcoming elections are through their campaigns, fragmenting the people along ethnic lines. And we want those of you out there who are listening to participate in this discussion. You can do so by calling in or emailing. You can call the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599, or you can call the U.K. number, which is 020-8133-6629. You can call us through Skype for free anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and it's all one word, all lowercase, or email us at dj@uhururadio.com. Comrade Chernow, you... you sent the letter to ECOWAS. What was the response from ECOWAS to the letter?
Well, from what we understand, that an acknowledgement has been sent to the Media Forum Secretariat in the Gambia, informing them that the letter has been received and that it will be considered. So we expect a meeting, an ECOWAS meeting to happen, which we might be invited to attend in Lagos to discuss the contents of that letter. But from what we understand, the government, the military government in Guinea, has held a press conference, and the current interim leader of the coalition government, General Konate, has appointed a special committee led by another military officer that is called Nuhu Cham. Major General Nuhu Cham, who conveyed the press conference, and among other things, he claimed that the assessment that was done of the political situation in Guinea by the West African Media Forum was, according to him, one-sided, and that it was biased. And as far as he is concerned, he thinks that we are not independent of the political situation in Guinea. So, based on his assessment, he feels that we do not have the authority to assess, but he actually confirmed that the current activities of some political parties of concern, according to him, and he warned that campaigning should not mean the smashing of somebody's car or the destruction of another person's business enterprise because they belong to various parties and things like that. So, from what we understand, he also said that ECOWAS, through the leadership of ECOWAS, the Guinean military regime has put together a 16,000 military force made up of 16,000 troops made up of paramilitary and military forces who will be deployed right across Guinea to police the elections and to provide security during the elections and during the campaign so that these forces will be mandated primarily to provide security and to prevent the escalation of violence. But we are saying that no amount of military force is sufficient enough to guarantee us the security of our people in Guinea, because what we think has to be done is a sufficient time has to be given for the development and implementation of a mass education campaign, political education campaign, that will expose these fraudulent tactics of these politicians. And also we feel that the current political groups themselves, you know, have not had the situation, and their leaders were part of the crisis that that country said they created that crisis. They have been part of the regime of Lassana Conte that created the situation that we are confronted with in that country. So we feel that they have no legitimacy, no credibility to contest for any office. So any solution in Guinea has to take into consideration some of these issues. But there is no solution in the government. The government has denied, of course, we expect that to happen. They have denied that our assessment is one-sided. They have denied, they have said, they claim that it's one-sided, but they have consented to what we said, that the campaign messages, you know, are divisive. They are contained in ethnic, contained and wrapped in ethnic ideas. So the fact that Nuhu Cham himself will come on TV and accept that situation and say that the activities of some political parties are of concern to the people and to the military regime itself is a clear acceptance of our assessment of the situation. Mm-hmm. So we feel that he has contradicted himself also if they haven't created a situation of violence, there will be no reason why they should put together 16,000 troops made up of paramilitary and military forces just for election purposes. So we are saying that that is not the solution. The solution is the postponement of the elections and the development and implementation of a public political education program that will help people to understand what their interest is, and the development of a program, you know, that will allow the vast majority of people to understand that the messages and slogans and campaign tactics and activities of the various political parties in Guinea that are contesting for the president of that country are nothing but programs that are divisive, that are inimical to the growth and the salvation of our people in that area. So this is what we feel. So we feel that, and we are hoping that the meeting in Lagos will take into consideration some of these issues, and that we still hope that we will be able to impress upon ECOWAS and the various leaders to understand that the necessity and the urgency of reverting the time for these elections and the development of our public education campaign that will allow for the sufficient education of our people and an education program that will expose some of these fraudulent ideas and tactics that are used by these neo-colonial parties contending for the presidency of that country.
You're listening to Africa Live here on AhuruRadio.com. We're speaking with Cherno Alpha Mbah, the director of the Organization of the African Socialist International, who's joining us live over the phone from West Africa. We're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk a bit more about Guinea-Conakry and also about Sierra Leone, where the African People's Socialist Party of Sierra Leone was practically banned. And we're going to talk about developments with that. So stick with us here on Africa Live on AhuruRadio.com.
Get ready now for one of the most important events of our time, the 5th Congress of the African People's Socialist Party. The Congress convenes on July 10th through 14th in Washington, D.C. under the slogan, One People, One Party, One Destiny. Hear presentations by African People's Socialist Party Chairman Omali Eshetela and other leaders of the APSP, and witness as the party ushers in a new era of struggle. A new day is on the horizon. The U.S. front of the African Revolution will never be the same. For more info on the Congress, go to www.apspcongress.org or call 727-821-6620.
Salon today, salon today, like yesterday. Salon today, Papa God, sorry for ye. Idam baku, na disto. Idam baku, any size so so kota. Say we de ask for the right leader, na disto. Papa, sorry for you, give we leader, na we land.
Say money not they for pay your school fee. You talk sad and they say you could go sad. Say we don't know how for wrong things. I don't know how for live life. Papa God, I ain't go sorry for my mind.
Set sail with the Uhuru Movement and the African People's Socialist Party on December 12th through 18th for a 7-day cruise to Key West, Grand Cayman, and Ocho Rios, Jamaica aboard the luxurious Carnival Freedom cruise ship. Special guests include our very own Chairman Omali Eshetela, leader of the Uhuru Movement, and the very talented Ron Bob Simple, creator of The Spirit of Marcus Garvey, a one-man show in which Simple delivers an uncanny exactness of the legendary Garvey, transporting the onlooker back to the time of the revolutionary spirit that gave birth to the African Socialist International. Cabin prices are from $519 per person. Double occupancy and deposits start as low as $50 today, $250 by July 12th. For more information, please visit our website at uhurulegacycruise.com. That's UhuruLegacyCruise.com. Book your room today with Tanya's Travel by calling 352-232-2131 or by email at tanyastravel@bellsouth.net. We hope you all can set sail with us on the ship named for our struggle, freedom. Uhuru.
Uhuru, and welcome back to Africa Live here on UhuruRadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we've been interviewing up to now Colonel Alpha Mba, the Director of Organization of the African Socialist International, and President of the West Africa Media Forum. And we've been talking about the situation in Guinea-Conakry, and we'll also be talking, we want to go into now some discussion about Sierra Leone, where last November a conference was held to launch the process of building the African People's Socialist Party of Sierra Leone. And recently, the government of Sierra Leone practically banned the party there. Comrade Cherno, can you say for our listeners who may not be familiar with the issue, what led to the banning of the African People's Socialist Party of Sierra Leone?
Like you said, Sierra Leone has been controlled by middle-class neo-colonial forces from 1961, they will tend to refer to as independence, the period that witnessed the transition to from direct colonialism to neo-colonialism. So what we had from 1961 up to now is a situation where two political factions representing the same class of individuals, the middle-class African petites who have been ruling and controlling power in this country, have enjoyed a monopoly as far as governance issues are concerned for almost 50 years now, unchallenged. So in November, we held the National Consultative Conference, a three-day National Consultative Conference in Freetown that resulted in the establishment of a Revolutionary Workers' Party, the first socialist party in Sierra Leone, that, among other things, is trying to take back power to these middle-class forces and ensure that the African working class will become the new ruling class. So that happened in November with the inauguration of an interim leadership committee led by myself, that is tasked with the responsibility of organizing, putting together the various arrangements, developing party constitution, and the various other issues that will result in the organization of a Congress, the first Congress, wherein actual leadership and a program will be adopted. So subsequent to that, immediately, a month after the inauguration of the party, the government, the current APC government led by Ernest Koroma, decided to implement a new economic policy, which, among other things, include the development or an increase in a 50% increase in the prices of all basic commodities, goods and services in the country. So we felt that as a party, that this was something that was designed to further escalate the misery and hardship that we are confronted with in this country. So we decided to call a press conference to express our dismay and our opposition to this situation, because we said that what the government, this new economic policy of the government, is one that is designed to worsen the current misery that the people are faced with, and one that will collapse the economy. So we call for the withdrawal of the tax, and this economic policy is one that is designed by the IMF and the various multinational agencies, the EU, the World Bank. You know, it's just similar to the social adjustment program of the World Bank and the IMF during the 70s and 80s, you know, that bankrupted African economies at the time and created devastation, you know, within the continent and other areas of the world. So we felt that we should not allow the repetition or implementation of such a policy, and we expressed our complete opposition to this situation. So because of our open position, we were the only group that came out to speak, you know, in defense of the interests of the people, because everybody rejected the tax, but the government, you know, felt that because of this situation, we are trying to expose them to a situation that will allow for the people to come out on the street and demonstrate against such a policy. So as part of the very, very many legislations that they have and institutions that they have, they decided to use the Political Parties Registration Commission and a certain provision within the Political Parties Act of 2002, which says that any group that decides to function as a political party should be registered as a party. Otherwise, it is violating the law. So they decided to ban us. But we are saying that by so doing, the PPRC also acted contrary to the law, because the fact is that we are working with the requirements of the National Constitution, the 1991 Constitution, which says that the right to association, the right to conscience, is something that is free, that should not be controlled by any individual, that we have the right to form and be part of any organization of our choice and to uphold any political view and a position, and we also have the right to expression. So, but the PPRC came into this situation because we have been holding press conferences talking about the formation of the party. We even held a 3-day special consultative conference that was broadcasted on the media. It was on the media. We held several radio discussions during the time, and it was reported on the newspapers. It was also on the radio stations, on the national TV, but the PPRC, or no one said anything until we decided to express our opposition to this new tax legislation, that we feel that it's nothing but one that is designed to increase the suffering and hardship that we experience, as if, you know, that our people are experiencing, which we felt was completely unjustifiable and one that is unacceptable. And we called on the government to withdraw that. So they felt that by so doing, we were affecting the interests of the various imperialist forces who have advised or who promoted the idea of the introduction of such a tax legislation. So this is eventually what caused the government, or led the government, to use the PPRC and the secondary legislation that they have that equally contradict the national constitution to ban the African People's Socialist Party, to ban us from the issue of the public statement saying that we have no right to organize meetings, to hold political rallies, to issue out statements in the name of the African People's Socialist Party until we are fully registered by the Political Party Registration Commission. But the question is not, it's not related to the fact that we are not registered, because we have, you know, in the past we had the People's Movement for Democratic Change, PMDC, which operated as a party more than a year before it was before it went and registered as a party. Nobody complained at the time, but it has become an issue because ours is not a party that is a breakaway faction of the middle class. It is a party of the workers and the poor peasants who have suffered decades of political oppression and exploitation, who are experiencing daily misery, whose situations have grown worse, who are experiencing hardship as a consequence of the theft and the plunder of our resources by multinational corporations. Individuals who are not living beyond their 37th birthday, a situation where 3 of every 5 women who give birth to children are dying in labor, where there is no public transportation, there are no adequate social services that are required for human existence. So it's we who have formed a party, an organization, to organize ourselves so that we will free ourselves from this situation. And this is what the middle class has found very offensive and which they cannot accept, and which is why they have used the various institutions and the various legislations that they have to muzzle us and to seek to exclude us from the political process in this country. And that is what they have done for the last, since January up to now. That is what they have done by issuing a ban on our activities. And they have this criteria that we have to fulfill, which is very difficult for workers who are not employed, who live on barely less than $1 a day to afford, by saying that every individual wishing to function, a group wishing to function as a political party, should have offices, should, you should pay, you know, fee, you should pay to organize yourself, you know, you have to fulfill all of these requirements. And these requirements, this secondary legislation, contradict the primary legislation, the national constitution, which says that the right to association, the right to assemble, the right to conscience, and the right to expression are free. You know, so mm-hmm. now they have secondary legislation that they have created that contradict this primary legislation. But it's a question of power. It's because they control the police, they control the legislation and all of these things, and they have decided to use these institutions and legislations that they have to control the population, and they've been doing this for decades, and they have tried with this situation and challenge for 50 years now, almost 50 years now. This is how they have kept the people hostage to poverty, to hardship, to underdevelopment, to oppression and exploitation of our resources.
Mm. Now, we have a question that's come in through Skype, actually. This is from Femi in the UK, who says, has Mr. Ba and the Uhuru movement considered the establishment of a West African or regional bureau that would incorporate a comprehensive long-term strategy for the region, including Nigeria, Ghana, and other ECOMOG countries? It seems pointless to deal with the same issues in various countries on a piecemeal basis, or rather time-wasting. So can you speak to that? Go ahead.
Yes, we have. The African Socialist International has been operating here for 5 years now. From 2005, we have been active on the ground. We have membership, a large membership in Sierra Leone, as it is. We are responsible for the introduction of socialist discourse and workers' alternative and a program that is designed for the elevation of the African working class and the poor peasants to the status of being the actual rulers in this situation, in this part of the continent. So we have also a regional committee of African Socialist International. I function as the regional chair of the AFI. The secretariat is run by the Congress in Conakry. Comrade Madi Dano functions as regional secretary of the AFI. And we also have individuals in various parts of the region, in Liberia, in Nigeria, in various parts of the region, who have been functioning, who has a relationship with African Socialist International. Very recently, we have concluded a visit to Conakry, to Ivory Coast, and to Burkina Faso as part of the process of highlighting the situation of exposing the various new colonial legislations in these microstates, and also developing plans and strategies of harmonizing the various approaches to the struggle against injustice, to the struggle for national democratic rights, and for the liberation and unification of African and African people into a common trajectory. So we have gone through this process. In the next couple of weeks, we are also we also expect to make a similar visit to the Gambia, to comrades who have invited us, who are desirous of being part of this process, and we hope also to visit Senegal and Mali as part of this other trip. Before then, in February, I led a delegation from Nigeria that went to Cameroon and also Accra, Ghana. These are all part of the process of synchronizing and sharing experiences, understanding the nature of the oppression and injustice that is being perpetuated by these various new colonial governments and their various agents and forces within this region against our people, and to see how progressive forces, revolutionary forces, and other sectors of the population that are organized could be part of an international process, a common process, that is designed to expose and struggle against this situation on the regional and international basis. So we have this situation. We, like, apart from the African Socialist International, the West African Media Forum that we are also part of, is made up of individuals, journalists, and people, media professionals, who are also organized as part of a network that is designed to expose and highlight some of these oppressive tendencies or processes and legislations that are inimical to progress, to democratic values, to human rights, and good governance. We expose this to other organizations who will take this discussion to other parts of the world. And part of the process
his name and shamed this individual and exposed them and allowed the rest of the world to know that these are not credible individuals and that they are responsible for the current crisis that we continue to experience in that area. So we feel that, yes, there is a regional approach that takes into consideration on a general basis the regional questions as they appear and the uniformity of the problem. We felt that over the last 40 to 50 years, what we have witnessed in West Africa is the growth of oppressive regimes who have flourished at the expense of all democratic and human rights values. And we also think that we have to develop an alternative program that will allow a concerted effort towards the struggle against these oppressive regimes, these oppressive institutions and laws and legislations and principles that they have developed to keep themselves in power and also allow the continuous growth of draconian laws and draconian regimes at the expense of all values that promote human dignity, peace, and the rights of our people in this part of the continent. We also recognize that there is need for added capacity. There is need for more organized efforts that will take into consideration the development of the consciousness of our people, political education, adequate political education, and the acquiring of tools and strategies that will increase our capacity to achieve our objectives and heighten our goals. So this is where I think that comprehensive discussions like these ones and wherever we are, we should be able to put together whatever we can, ideas, resources, and everything we can to achieve our objectives.
Uhuru, we're running out of time. I wanna see if there's, well, first of all, we did get another comment that came in that said, without a particular focus on Nigeria, a nation of more than 120 million black Africans, we are wasting time. Apart from its natural and human resources, Nigeria represents the crown and the jewel. And given the conditions of our people over there, it is particularly ripe, a good breeding ground for Mr. Ba and the Uhuru movement. So I want to ask, just off the back of that, will there be work to organize in Nigeria? And also, if you can say in closing, what you would call on people to do who are listening from around the world to intervene in the situations in both Guinea and Sierra Leone?
Yes, regarding the question on Nigeria, we know that the nature of oppression in that area is not in the genus, maybe specific to Nigeria alone. The question of oppression, the experiences are the same wherever we are located. If you listen to what the communists are saying about the Gambia, then you will be amazed. You will think people in the Gambia feel that the oppression that they are faced with from Yahya Jammeh supersedes every other thing that is happening. Likewise, Africans in Guinea think the same, that and equally in Sierra Leone. So even in Kenya. So what we are saying is that there is a general trend of oppression that we experience wherever we are as African people. So we are currently in the process of seeing how we can organize effectively in Nigeria. We have individual contacts, individuals who have expressed desire to be part of the African Socialist International, and we are in the process of developing a plan of action that will, among other things, result in the holding of conferences, meetings, seminars, and programs that will eventually result in the establishment of the ASI in Nigeria and the African People's Socialist Party eventually in that area. And we feel that that is something that is urgent, in as much as it's also urgent to build in the Gambia, build in Senegal, in Mali, in Kenya, in Tanzania, in Uganda, wherever we are, in the UK, in the Caribbean, wherever we are, to build this single organization that is designed to fight for our own liberation and fight for our own oppression. That is, you know, we need concrete programs and plans of action that will help us to achieve the capacity that we need to fulfill our objective and our mission. So that is what it is. And we think that what I would just say about Sierra Leone and Guinea is that we want, wherever we are, that we should help to prevent what is happening in Guinea-Conakry. Because whatever happens in Guinea, if there's an ethnic crisis in Guinea between the Mandingos and the Fulani, or the Mandingos and the Susus, we also have the same ethnic communities in Sierra Leone, in Ivory Coast, in Burkina Faso, and in Nigeria. So one crisis between two sets of ethnic communities in Guinea has the possibility of spreading across the borders, of affecting the same ethnic communities in Sierra Leone and in Mali, or wherever these communities live in proximity with each other. And West Africa generally is peopled by the same ethnic communities, by the same people. We have the same patterns of migration and same patterns of settlement. So if we will not struggle to contain and prevent what's about to happen in Guinea from happening, then we fear that we might have a situation where the well-being and the lives and property of the ordinary masses who have suffered centuries of oppression and exploitation will also be worsened by some of these situations. So we want everyone to do whatever they can to help with this situation and help to prevent it from happening. And we also want the world to know that we are faced with this situation in Sierra Leone. We'll be calling on next month an emergency meeting to talk about the registration of the party and also plans of action regarding an alternative campaign program that will help to expose some of the fraudulent legislations that we have in Sierra Leone that militate against the ability of the workers to organize themselves to free ourselves from this situation. So we will want Africans and our friends, wherever they are, who can support this, to provide whatever support they can to increase the capacity that we have to the level that we will be able to do whatever we can to achieve our objectives. Uhuru.
Uhuru. I want to thank you very much, comrade, for coming on with us again to update our listeners on the situation there, both in Guinea and in Sierra Leone. Just want to we'll be keeping abreast of the situation there. So we'll probably be talking to you again in the near future with more updates on that situation. So I want to what we're going to do now is we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back in just a moment with more discussion here on Africa Live on UhuruRadio.com.
Of Malcolm X, what men got vexed? They didn't want to see black men progress, and all along the way, black men have strayed, searching to find the way. Many prospect was to see, yeah. All men live in unity, but now he is down, whoa, down in the ground. Where can the killers be found? I wanna know. Till all my brothers see, yeah, the hidden brutality. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's been hidden from our eyes much too long. Yeah, oh yeah.
Joseph, Malcolm X, what men got best. They didn't want to see black men progress, and all along the way black men have strayed, searching to find the way. See, yeah, the hidden brutality. Yeah, yeah, yeah. How long will it be? Yes, yeah. It's been hidden from our eyes for too long. Yeah. We gotta know the
truth. And welcome back to Africa Live here on TheWhoRadio.com. You were just listening to Dennis Brown singing the song Malcolm X. That was a great song. But we want to talk briefly just about Malcolm X. On last week, we played a small excerpt from a speech that he made in 1964, April 8th, 1964, on Black Revolution. And we're going to play the remainder of that speech today. But I want to say a little bit about Malcolm before we do. One of the reasons why we're talking about Malcolm X at the moment is because his birthday was this past week, May 19th. Of course, Malcolm was an incredible leader, one who we feel we have to hold up, not in some way to just talk about, somebody who did something good in history, but also to raise up an example of who we all should be as African people, as oppressed peoples, who how we have to be in order to grasp the future in our own hands. And, Malcolm X is such an example. He was an incredible, incredible leader who really burned with a love for African people, and was an internationalist, an African internationalist, who recognized the connection between Africans in the U.S. And everywhere else around the world. Who recognized that oppressed peoples all suffered from the same problem, and that problem was imperialism. Malcolm X was a giant, and he was someone who was was a real dynamic force, and one who was constantly growing, but the U.S. government stopped our leader Malcolm X's growth. They murdered him on February 21st, 1965. And so it is fallen on our shoulders to carry on this struggle, to carry on the development of our movement ideologically. Because that's one of the things that Malcolm X really did. He really struggled with ideas and to help us to understand this beast that we're struggling against, and our oppression, but it's fallen upon our shoulders to carry on the struggle to liberate our people, we wanna hold up Malcolm X, and that's one of the reasons why the African People's Socialist Party, a long time ago, established February 21st as African Martyrs Day. And of course, again, February 21st is the day that the U.S. government murdered Malcolm X. One of the reasons why they did murder him in the manner that they did was to make Africans back away from struggling, for our freedom. That's the reason why they did it in such a brutal manner. But, you know, we hold him up and other martyrs of our struggle up on February 21st sort of to take away that from my oppressors, you know, and hold them up as examples of who we have to be, how we have to be, if we're to be free. And I'm reminded also of Malcolm because 3 days following his birthday, our community buried another one of our children. On yesterday, the African community had to bury our child, Ayanna Jones, who in Detroit, who was just 7 years old, and we had to bury her because the U.S. government murdered her through its military force that they call the police, that they use in the African community to brutalize and murder our people in order to prevent us from organizing and standing up and struggling for our freedom. And 7-year-old Ayanna Jones was sleeping, you know, in the home with her grandmother when this military force of when they busted in the house, shooting flashbang grenades and they shot this baby in the head as she slept, right before her grandmother's eyes. And so, you know, I'm reminded of when Malcolm talked about, you know, when the four little African girls were murdered with the bombing of the church in the 1960s, and how Malcolm said, as long as the white man sent you to Korea, you bled. He sent you to Germany, and you bled. He sent you to South Pacific to fight the Japanese, and you bled. You bled for white people, but when it comes to seeing your own churches being bombed and little black girls murdered, you haven't got any blood. You bleed when the white man says bleed. You bite when the white man says bark. And you bark, and you know, you bite when the white man says bite, and bark when the white man says bark. And he was saying that to say, you know, talking about the Black Revolution and how it's something that involves bloodshed, and how not just that, but how, you know, if we can fight for imperialism in all these wars, then damn it, we need to be fighting, you know, to defend our community, to defend our children. And I was reminded of that, you know, in thinking about Ayanna Jones, who the police murdered. You know, the baby didn't even get to see her 8th birthday. And it should incense every African on this planet, you know, who sees these types of things happen to our children, to say no more, you know, just say no more. This can't happen no more. And you know, it behooves us to stand up and organize and fight, because that's our child, you know. She didn't just belong to her father and her mother and her grandmother who watched as they killed her. But she belonged to all of us, to African people. And it is, you know, we have to stand up. We got to stand up and struggle for our freedom and to end this type of assault that happens on our community. And you know, so we got to stand up, and that's what is so makes it so important for us to be at this 5th Congress of the African People's Socialist Party that's happening in D.C. In July 10th through 14th. We got to be prepared to organize, you know, to defend our community, not just defend our community, but to overturn this parasitic relationship with imperialism that requires these types of things to happen, that requires, you know, a military force to be in our communities attacking our people, attacking our children, you know, in order to maintain this relationship We got to end that. And in ending that means we have to get organized. And the organization that's going to make that happen is the African People's Socialist Party. So I wanted to say that before we play the rest of the speech from Malcolm X. And this is, again, the remainder of the speech on the Black Revolution that Malcolm did in 1964, this April 8th, 1964. So, yeah, I wanted to play that.
Fight for independence right here. And when I say fight for independence right here, I don't mean any nonviolent fight or turn the other cheek fight. Those days are gone. Those days are over. If George Washington didn't get independence for this country nonviolently, and if Patrick Henry didn't come up with a nonviolent statement, and you taught me to look upon them as patriots and heroes, then it's time for you to realize I have studied your books well. Our people, 22 million African Americans, are fed up with America's hypocritical democracy. And today we care nothing about the odds that are against us. Every time a black man gets ready to defend himself, some Uncle Tom starts trying to tell us, how can you win? That's Tom talking. Don't listen to him. This is the first thing we hear. The odds are against us. You're dealing with black people who don't care anything about odds. We care nothing about odds. Again, I go right back to the people who founded and who secured the independence of this country from the colonial powers of England. When George Washington and the others got ready to declare or come up with a Declaration of Independence, they didn't care anything about the odds of the British Empire. They were fed up with taxation without representation. And you've got 22 million black people in this country today, 1964, who are fed up with taxation without representation and will do the same thing. Who are ready, willing, and justified to do the same thing today to bring about independence for our people that your forefathers did to bring about independence for your people. And I say your people because I certainly couldn't include myself among those for whom independence was fought in 1776. How in the world can a Negro talk about the Declaration of Independence and he's still singing, "We Shall Overcome"? Our people increasingly are developing the opinion that we just have nothing to lose but the chains of segregation and the chains of second-class citizenship. So 1964, we'll see the Negro revolt evolve and merge into the worldwide black revolution that has been taking place on this earth since 1945. The so-called revolt will become a real black revolution. Now, the black revolution has been taking place in Africa and Asia and in Latin America. When I say black, I mean non-white. Black, brown, red, or yellow. Our brothers and sisters in Asia who were colonized by the Europeans, our brothers and sisters in Africa who were colonized by the Europeans, and in Latin America, the peasants who were colonized by the Europeans, have been involved in a struggle since 1945 to get the colonialists or the colonizing power, the Europeans, off their land, out of their country. This is a real revolution. Revolution is always based on land. Revolution is never based on begging somebody for an integrated cup of coffee. Revolutions are never fought by turning the other cheek. Revolutions are never based upon love your enemy and pray for those who despitefully use you. And revolutions are never waged saying, "We shall overcome." Revolutions are based on bloodshed. Revolutions are never compromising. Revolutions are never based upon negotiation. Revolutions are never based upon any kind of tokenism whatsoever. Revolutions are never even based upon that which is begging a corrupt society or a corrupt system to accept us into it. Revolutions overturn systems. And there is no system on this earth has proven itself more corrupt, more criminal than the system that raped 1972. Then this system that in 1964 still colonizes African Americans, still enslaves 22 million Afro-Americans. There is no system more corrupt than a system that represents itself as the example of freedom, the example of democracy, and can go all over this earth telling other people how to straighten out their house, and you have half of the citizens in this country who have to use bullets if they want to cast a ballot. The greatest weapon that the colonial powers have used in the past against our people has always been divide and conquer. America is a colonial power. She has colonized 22 million Afro-Americans by depriving us of first-class citizenship, by depriving us of civil rights, actually by depriving us of human rights. She's not only deprived us of the right to be a citizen, she's deprived us of the right to be a human being. The right to be recognized and respected as men and women. And in this country, a black man can be 50 years old. He's still a boy. I grew up with white people. I was integrated before they invented the word. And I have never met white people yet, if you don't be around them long enough, who won't refer to you as a boy or a gal, no matter how old you are, no matter what school you came out of, no matter what your intellectual or professional level is. In this society, we remain boys. So America's strategy is the same strategy as that which was used by the past, by the colonial powers. Divide and conquer. She plays one Negro leader against the other. She plays one Negro organization against the other. She makes us think that we have different objectives, different goals. As soon as one Negro says something, she runs to this Negro and asks him, what do you think about what he said? Why, anybody can see through that today. Except some of the Negro leaders. All of our people have the same goal, the same objective: freedom, justice, equality. All of us want recognition and respect as human beings. We don't want to be integrationists, nor do we want to be separationists. We want to be human beings. Integration is only a method that's used by some groups to obtain freedom, justice, equality, and respect as human beings. Separation is only a method that's used by other groups to obtain freedom, justice, equality, or human dignity. So our people have made the mistake of confusing the methods with the objectives. As long as we agree on objectives, we should never fall out with each other just because we believe in different methods or tactics or strategy to reach a common objective. We have to keep in mind at all times that we aren't fighting for integration, nor are we fighting for separation. We're fighting for recognition as human beings. We're fighting for the right to live as free humans in this society. In fact, we're actually fighting for rights that are even greater than civil rights. And that is human rights. We are fighting for human rights in 1964. This is a shame. The civil rights struggle has failed to produce concrete results because it has kept us barking up the wrong tree. It has made us put the cart ahead of the horse. We must have human rights before we can secure civil rights. We must be respected as humans before we can be recognized as citizens. Among the so-called Negroes in this country, as a rule, the civil rights groups, or those who believe in civil rights, they spend most of their time trying to prove that they are American. Their thinking is usually domestic, confined to the boundaries of America, and they always look upon themselves as a minority. When they look upon themselves on the American stage is a white stage. So a black man standing on that stage in America automatically is in the minority. He's the underdog. And in his struggle, he always uses an approach that's a begging, hat-in-hand, compromise approach. Whereas the other segment or faction in America known as the nationalists, black nationalists, are more interested in human rights than they are in civil rights. And they place more stress on human rights than they do in civil rights. The difference between the thinking and the scope of the Negroes who are involved in the human rights struggle and those in the civil rights struggle, those so-called Negroes involved in the human rights struggle don't look upon themselves as Americans. They look upon themselves as a part of dark mankind. They see the whole struggle not within the confines of the American stage, but they look upon the struggle on the world stage. And in the world context, they see that the dark man outnumbers the white man. On the world stage, the white man is just a microscopic minority. So in this country, you find two different types of Afro-Americans. The type who looks upon himself as the minority and you as the majority, because its scope is limited to the American scene. Then you have the type who looks upon himself as part of the majority and you as part of a microscopic minority. And this one uses a different approach in trying to struggle for his rights. He doesn't dare. He doesn't thank you for what you give him, because you're only giving him what he should have had 100 years ago. He doesn't think you're doing him any favors. He doesn't see any progress that he has made since the Civil War. He sees not one iota of progress, because number one, if the Civil War had freed him, he wouldn't need civil rights legislation today. If the Emancipation Proclamation issued by that great shining liberal called Lincoln had freed him, he wouldn't be singing "We Should Overcome" today. If the amendments to the Constitution had solved his problem, still his problem wouldn't be here today. And even if the Supreme Court desegregation decision of 1954 was genuinely and sincerely designed to solve his problem, the problem wouldn't be with us today. So this kind of black man is thinking. He can see where every maneuver that America has made, supposedly to solve his problem, has been nothing but political trickery and treachery of the worst order. So today he doesn't have any confidence in these so-called liberals. Now, I know most of you all coming in here tonight, you don't call yourselves liberals. Because that's a nasty name today. It represents hypocrisy. So these two different types of black people exist in the Negro, so-called Negro community. And they are beginning to wake up, and their awakening is producing a very dangerous situation. So you have whites in the community who express sincerity when they say they want to help. Well, how can they help? How can a white person help the black man solve his problem? Number one, you can't solve it for him. You can help him solve it, but you can't solve it for him today. One of the best ways that you can solve it, or help him solve it, is to let the so-called Negro who's been involved in the civil rights struggle see that the civil rights struggle must be expanded beyond the level of civil rights to the level of human rights. Once it is expanded beyond the level of civil rights to the level of human rights, it opens the door for all of our brothers and sisters in Africa and Asia who have their independence to come to our rescue. Why? When you go to Washington, D.C., expecting those crooks down there to pass some kind of, and that's what they are, to pass some kind of civil rights legislation to correct a very criminal situation, what you're doing is encouraging the black man who is the victim to take his case into the court that's controlled by the criminal. It'll never be solved in that way. It's like running from the wolf to the fox. The civil rights struggle involves the black man taking his case to the white man's court. But when he fights it at the human rights level, it's a different situation. It opens the door for him to take Uncle Sam to world court. The black man shouldn't have to go to court to be free. Uncle Sam should be taken to court and made to tell why the black man is not free in a so-called free society. Uncle Sam should be taken into the United Nations and charged with violating the UN Charter on Human Rights. You can forget civil rights. How are you going to get civil rights with men like Eastman and men like Dirksen and men like Johnson? It has to be taken out of their hands and taken into the hands of those whose power and authority exceeds theirs. Well, in those in the civil rights struggle, those so-called Negroes involved in the human rights struggle don't look upon themselves as Americans. They look upon themselves as a part of dark mankind. They see the whole struggle not within the confines of the American state, but they look upon the struggle on the world stage. And in the world context, they see that the dark man outnumbers the white man. On the world stage, the white man is just a microscopic minority. Well, in this country, you find two different types of Afro-American. The type who looks upon himself as the minority and you as the majority, because his scope is limited to the American scene. Then you have the type who looks upon himself as part of the majority and you as part of a microscopic minority. And this one uses a different approach in trying to struggle for his rights. He doesn't beg. He doesn't thank you for what you give him, because you're only giving him what he should have had 100 years ago. He doesn't think you're doing him any favors. He doesn't see any progress that he has made. Since the Civil War. He sees not one iota of progress, because, number one, if the Civil War had freed him, he wouldn't need civil rights legislation today. If the Emancipation Proclamation issued by that great shining liberal called Lincoln had freed him, he wouldn't be singing "We Should Overcome" today. If the amendments to the Constitution had solved his problem, still his problem wouldn't be here today. And even if the Supreme Court desegregation decision of 1954 was genuinely and sincerely designed to solve his problem, the problem wouldn't be with us today. So this kind of black man is thinking. He can see where every maneuver that America has made, supposedly to solve his problem, has been nothing but political trickery and treachery of the worst order. So today he doesn't have any confidence in these so-called liberals. Now, I know most of you all coming in here tonight, you don't call yourselves liberals. Because that's a nasty name today. It represents hypocrisy. So these two different types of black people exist in the Negro, so-called Negro community. And they are beginning to wake up, and their awakening is producing a very dangerous situation. So you have whites in the community who express sincerity when they say they want to help. Well, how can they help? How can a white person help the black man solve his problem? Number one, you can't solve it for him. You can help him solve it, but you can't solve it for him today. One of the best ways that you can solve it or help him solve it is to let the so-called Negro who's been involved in the civil rights struggle see that the civil rights struggle must be expanded beyond the level of civil rights to the level of human rights. Once it is expanded beyond the level of civil rights to the level of human rights, it opens the door for all of our brothers and sisters in Africa and Asia who have their independence to come to our rescue. Why? When you go to Washington, D.C., expecting those crooks down there to pass some kind of, and that's what they are. To pass some kind of civil rights legislation to correct a very criminal situation, what you're doing is encouraging the black man who is the victim to take his case into the court that's controlled by the criminal that made him the victim. It'll never be solved in that way. It's like running from the wolf to the fox. The civil rights struggle involves the black man taking his case to the white man's court. But when he fights it at the human rights level, it's a different situation. It opens the door for him to take Uncle Sam to world court. The black man shouldn't have to go to court to be free. Uncle Sam should be taken to court and made to tell why the black man is not free in a so-called free society. Uncle Sam should be taken into the United Nations and charged with violating the UN Charter on Human Rights. You can forget civil rights. How are you going to get civil rights with men like Eastman and men like Dustin and men like Johnson? It has to be taken out of their hands and taken into the hands of those whose power and authority exceeds theirs. Washington has become too corrupt. Uncle Sam's conscience. Uncle Sam has become bankrupt when it comes to a conscience. It's impossible for Uncle Sam to solve the problem of 22 million black people in this country. It is absolutely impossible to do it in Uncle Sam's court. Whether it's the Supreme Court or any other kind of court that comes under Uncle Sam's jurisdiction. The only alternative that the black man in America has today is to take it out of Senator Dixon and Senator Eastman and President Johnson's jurisdiction and take it downtown on the East River and place it before that body of men who represent international law. And let them know that the human rights of black people are being invited and being violated in a country that professes to be the moral leader of the free world. Anytime you have a filibuster in America, in the Senate, in 1964, over the rights of 22 million black people, over the citizenship of 22 million black people, or that will affect the freedom and the justice and the equality of 22 million black people, it's time for that government itself to be taken before a world court. How can you condemn South Africa? There's only 11 million of our people in South Africa. There are 22 million of them here. And we are receiving an injustice that is just as criminal as that which is being done to the black people of South Africa. So today, those whites who profess to be liberal, and as far as I'm concerned, it's just lip profession. You understand why our people don't have civil rights? You're white. You can go and hang out with another white liberal and see how hypocritical they are. Why, a lot of you sitting right here know that you've seen whites up in a Negro's face with flowery words, and as soon as that Negro walks away, you listen to how your white friend talks. We have black people who can pass as white. We know how you talk. We can see that it is nothing but a governmental conspiracy to continue to deprive the black people in this country of their rights. And the only way we will get those rights restored is by taking it out of Uncle Sam's hands. Take him to court and charge him with genocide. The mass murder of millions of black people in this country, political murder, economic murder, social murder, mental murder, this is the crime that this government has committed, and if you yourself don't do something about it in time, then you're going to open the doors for something to be done about it from outside forces. I read in the paper yesterday where one of the chief justices, Goldberg, was crying about the violation of human rights of 3 million Jews in the Soviet Union. Imagine this. I haven't got anything against the Jews, but That's their problem. How you in the world you're going to cry about problems on the other side of the world and you haven't got the problem straightened out here? How can the plight of 3 million Jews in Russia be qualified to be taken to the United Nations by a man who is a justice in this Supreme Court and is supposed to be a liberal, supposed to be a friend of black people, and hasn't opened up his mouth one time about taking the plight of black people down there to the United Nations? People are becoming more politically mature. Their eyes are coming open. They're beginning to see the trend in all of the American politics today. They notice that every time there's an election, it's so close among whites that they have to count the votes over again. This happened in Massachusetts when they were running for governor. It happened in Rhode Island. It happened in Minnesota and many other places. And it happened in the election between Kennedy and Nixon. Things are so close that any minority who has a block vote can swing it either way. And I think most of the students of political science agree that it was the 80% support that Kennedy got from the black man in this country that enabled him to sit in the White House. He sat down there 4 years and the Negro is still in the doghouse. The same ones that we put in the White House have continued to keep us in the doghouse. The Negro can see that he holds the balance of power in this country politically. It is he who puts in office the one who gets in office. Yet when the Negro helps that person get in office, the Negro gets nothing in return. All he gets is a few appointments. A few hand-picked Uncle Tom handkerchief-head Negroes are given big jobs in Washington, D.C. And then those Negroes come back and try and make us think that that administration is going to lead us to the promised land of integration. And the only ones whose problem have been solved have been those hand-picked Negroes. A few big Negroes got jobs who didn't even need the job. They already were working. But the masses of black people are still unemployed. The present administration, the Democratic administration, has been down there for 4 years. Yet no meaningful legislation has been passed by them that's supposed to benefit black people in this country. Despite the fact that in the House they have 257 Democrats and only 177 are Republicans. They control two-thirds of the House. In the Senate there are 67 Democrats and only 33 Republicans. The Democrats control two-thirds of the government. And it's the Negroes who put them in position to control the government. Yet they give the Negroes nothing in return but a few handouts in the form of appointments that are only used as window dressing to make it appear that the problem is being solved. No, something is wrong. And when these black people wake up and find out for real the trickery and the treachery that has been heaped upon us, you're going to have revolution. And when I say revolution, I don't mean that stuff they were talking about last year about we shall overcome. That's no revolution. The Democrats get Negro support, yet the Negroes get nothing in return. The Negroes put the Democrats first, yet the Democrats put the Negroes last. And the alibi that the Democrats use, they blame the Dixocrats. A Dixocrat is nothing but a Democrat in disguise. You show me a Dixocrat and I'll show you a Democrat. And chances are you show me a Democrat and I'll show you a Dixocrat. Because Dixie in reality means all that territory south of the Canadian border. There are 16 senatorial committees that run this government. Of the 16 senatorial committees that run the government, 10 of them are controlled by chairmen who are from the South. Of the 20 congressional committees that help run the government, 12 of them are controlled by Southern segregationists. Think of this. 10 of the senatorial committees are in the hands of the Dixocrats. 12 of the 20 congressional committees are in the hands of the Dixocrats. These committees can still control the government. And you're going to tell us that the South lost the Civil War. The South controls the government. And they control it because they have seniority. And they have seniority because in the states that they come from, they deny Negroes the right to vote. If Negroes could vote south of the... If Negroes could vote south of, yes, Canadian border, if